VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Today is Friday, November the 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo stresses the importance of the NATO alliance.
I think NATO remains an important, critical, perhaps historically one of the most critical strategic partnerships in all of recorded history.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says NATO remains one of the most important strategic partnerships in all of recorded history. Speaking Thursday in Germany at an event commemorating the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the top U.S. diplomat said NATO had helped millions of people gain freedom and that the alliance still had a critical role amid its dangers posed by communist governments around the world. Pompeo's remarks came after French President Emmanuel Macron said in an interview that the lack of U.S. commitment is causing the brain death of NATO. VOA's Zlatka Hoge reports.
Speaking in the eastern German town of Leipzig, following a visit to a village divided after World War II, Secretary Pompeo said the transatlantic cooperation was critical in bringing about the fall of the Berlin Wall 30 years ago and is still relevant today.
There we were in this place where nations of democratic values worked so closely together for a long time to achieve what happened in 1989 and then again in 1990. Remarkable work that created freedom and brought millions of people out of very, very difficult situations. I think NATO remains an important, critical, perhaps historically one of the most critical strategic partnerships in all of recorded history.
Pompeo's praise of NATO came after President Macron claimed in an interview to The Economist magazine that the transatlantic alliance is suffering from brain death and that Europe cannot count on the United States for its defense. In a passionate plea to other European NATO members, Macron said the old continent is at the edge of a precipice and unless it wakes up, it will no longer be in control of its own destiny. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said she does not share Macron's view.
The French president has chosen drastic words. That is not my view of the cooperation in NATO. I don't think that such sweeping judgments are necessary, even if we have problems and need to pull together.
NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg said the alliance remains strong.
I welcome European unity. I welcome efforts to strengthen European defense. But European unity cannot replace transatlantic unity.
U.S. President Donald Trump's unexpected decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria, enabling another NATO member, Turkey, to invade, has raised questions about coordination within the alliance. A spokeswoman for the Russian Foreign Ministry said Macron's remarks were an accurate assessment of NATO's current state. During his election campaign, Trump said that NATO is obsolete. He has frequently accused European members of failing to live up to their NATO commitment to spend 2% of gross domestic product on defense. Pompeo said this proves the president is interested in keeping the alliance strong. Zlatica Hoge, VOA News, Washington.
This week, French President Emmanuel Macron described NATO as brain dead, stressing what he sees as a diminishing commitment to the transatlantic alliance by the U.S. Speaking to The Economist magazine, Macron denounced what he called American unilateralism and argued more European autonomy. So what does this mean for the future of this alliance? For that, I reached Stefano Marcuzzi, a researcher at Carnegie Europe, where he focuses on EU-NATO cooperation. All right, Mr. Marcuzzi, what do you make of these statements?
Well, you know, I think it's not just Macron. There's a mounting feeling among the general public, I would say, that NATO is not useful anymore. And I believe, you know, perhaps because NATO has provided security for 70 years, people begin to take it for granted. You know, at times it's the U.S. Blaming lesser allies for their limited financial commitment, you know, the so-called burden-sharing issue. This time, as you mentioned, it was the French president that lamented a progressive American disengagement from key areas where European interests are at stake. So Macron said Washington is turning its back on us. I don't think it was a criticism on NATO per se, but rather a criticism on the lack of cooperation among NATO allies.
What has the U.S. done to show that it's not cooperating with NATO as opposed to, say, previous administrations?
Well, you know, there's a trend in American foreign policy which actually dates back to Obama, the so-called Obama doctrine of disengagement from conflict areas, especially in the Middle East and the broader Mediterranean, which of course is leading the U.S. to withdraw from Libya, for example, from the Middle East more generally, and more recently from Syria, and of course all these areas are closer to Europe than they are to America. So that can be understandable from an American perspective, but from a European perspective, that means we are gonna have much worse problems to deal with, and we're gonna have to do it alone. So it's worrisome.
What would a Europe without NATO look like?
I'm not sure there can be a Europe without NATO. NATO is the security umbrella of the Western world. You know, I mean, let's be honest, NATO has problems. There's this dichotomy between Eastern Europe member states, which are concerned of Russia, so, you know, a more conventional competitor, and Mediterranean member states, which are more focused on asymmetrical threats emanating from the south, you know, the spread of terrorism, of sectarianism, human and arms smuggling, and civil wars, and so on. There is also a coordination problem when you have so many member states and their own exigencies and anxieties. But there, you know, there's also the will to stay together. After all, you know, NATO is the strongest alliance in history. So it has to adapt, for sure, but the idea that we can better provide security together than individually is still very much valid, in my opinion.
Has there been time in this past 70 years of NATO where they've had this type of challenge before, where they've had either competing interests among its member states or some member states saying that, you know, we don't feel like this is working for us?
Well, you know, in the 60s, France, withdrew from the operational headquarters of the alliance for a few years. So there have always been some tensions. But, of course, during the Cold War, there was a clear enemy, and everyone was concerned of the Soviet Union. And so differences were less pronounced somehow. Today, of course, because the international security scenario is much more multifaceted, the exigencies and the anxieties and the needs and the conflicting strategic views of member states can resurface more dramatically. But that doesn't mean that the alliance as a whole is not useful. You know, by the way, NATO is the only forum where you have Turkey and the U.S. and the bulk of the European Union member states around the same table. Mm. You don't have that in the European Security, in the UN Security Council, nor in any European institution. And NATO can also project stability in the Middle East. NATO is working with 41 partners, many of which are from the Middle East and can be strengthened with capacity building and occasionally with training in security and counterterrorism. So I think despite all the difficulties, this alliance is still useful in many ways.
That was Stefano Marcuzzi. He's a visiting researcher at Carnegie Europe. I reached him in Brussels. In Hong Kong, a student activist who fell from a parking garage after clashing with police officers died today
after succumbing to his injuries. Analysts say that this death could further escalate public anger after 5 months of anti-government demonstrations. Justin Solomon is a reporter covering the protests. I reached him in Hong Kong.
How is this development being received by protesters?
Well, it's not being received very well, as I'm sure you can imagine. So, as you said, a 22-year-old university student was allegedly at a protest late Sunday night into early Monday morning, and he fell from one floor of a parking garage to another while the police were in the process of dispersing the protest. Now, he'd been in the hospital for a week, and he had since, of course, as you said, passed away this morning. So the question that protesters are asking is, how, in fact, did he fall, and what kept ambulances from arriving quickly to tend to him? Mm. The authorities were ambulances were slow to respond, and they say it's because they were stuck behind, you know, traffic that was caused from the protest. The police today held a press conference, and they, of course, have said they will investigate this fully and that they did not have any part in delaying an ambulance to get to the scene or any part in why this student fell.
District council elections are coming up soon. Authorities, as we've learned, barred Joshua Wong, the prominent democracy activist, from running. How will these elections affect the protest, or rather the protest going to affect the elections?
Well, in a couple of ways. One, leading up to the elections, we've seen protesters on both sides physically attack candidates. A pro-Beijing candidate was stabbed this week. He was fine and in the hospital for just a few days and released. And just last week, a pro-democracy candidate was attacked by what we believe to be a pro-Beijing protester, and he had his ear partially bitten off. So the candidates are at risk themselves. And what people are expecting is the pro-democracy voters will turn out on November 24th and vote. And although it is just a district election, it is still an important election where whatever party has the majority actually wins seats on a committee of just 1,200 people who are responsible for selecting Hong Kong's chief executive. So the party with the most district councillors gets 117 seats on this committee. And that, of course, would worry Beijing if more pro-democracy leaders win.
So after the elections, we get into the holiday season. Are you expecting these protests to die down?
I don't think the protests are going to die down after the election as we approach the holidays. If anything, perhaps they could pick up, as it is a important time of year here in Asia, as Chinese New Year approaches in January. And in fact, the Hong Kong government recently, just the other day, announced that in these traditional Lunar New Year markets that are set up all over Hong Kong for the New Year, they are no longer going to allow the sale of dry goods and only allow the sale of flowers, which are a traditional good that they sell at these markets to celebrate the new year. That's a big deal because these dry goods can potentially be political related. They could be masks of political leaders or even pamphlets that have to do with political topics. Mm-hmm. So by the government cutting that out, they're basically trying to keep politics out of this, which generally means politics will be brought into
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as we come to the end of our conversation, real quick, how have these protests, as they enter their fifth month, how disruptive have they been to the daily lives of people in Hong Kong?
You know, that's a great question because, of course, what you hear on the radio and what you see on TV is these horrific images of clashes with protesters and police. And that is happening. Those images aren't made up. But life goes on here in Hong Kong. People get up in the morning, they go to work, they come home, they go out to dinner. It's fairly isolated when they do happen, and you can be somewhat aware of where they're happening, so you can avoid them, and you don't need to be in them if you don't want to be in them. So although tourism is down, restaurants are suffering because of that, hotels are suffering because of that, so the economy as a whole is suffering, life is continuing here, and
Hong Kong is Hong Kong.
You're listening to Voice of America's International Edition. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. These are some of the top stories in the world. The government of Pakistan will allow former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif to leave the country for medical treatment in the United Kingdom. But the foreign minister warned Sharif against seeking a second period of exile to escape corruption charges. And South Sudan's president and chief rebel met in Uganda yesterday and agreed upon postponing formation of a unity government for another 100 days. This is the third such delay in Sudan's and South Sudan's peace process. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. This Friday, November 8th, marks the third anniversary of Donald Trump's 2016 election as the 45th president of the United States. Trump remains a force of nature in American politics, but the third anniversary of his rise to power comes at a time when he's facing the greatest threat yet to his presidency, an impeachment inquiry led by congressional Democrats over his efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
3 years have passed since that November night when Donald Trump shocked the world with his election as the nation's 45th president.
To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
That early appeal for unity faded long ago.
But the more America achieves, the more hateful and enraged these crazy Democrats become.
Trump is now counting on his loyal base of supporters to first withstand impeachment and then carry him to re-election next year.
At stake in this fight is the survival of American democracy itself. Don't kid yourself. That's what they want. They are destroying this country, but we will never let it happen, not even close.
The impeachment probe in the House is focused on Trump's alleged efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden. Biden has made Trump the issue in his bid to win the Democratic Party's presidential nomination next year.
He talks about there will be a civil war. This is the guy that's unhinged. He is unhinged. I worry about what he's going to do, not about me or my family. I worried about what he'll do in the next year in the presidency.
Like so much in Trump's presidency, the impeachment inquiry is playing out along party lines, says analyst John Fortier.
For Democrats, they believe the president has done something wrong, and they think they're going to bring out more evidence. And I think their hope is that that will turn public opinion against the president, perhaps allow him to be removed. Republicans, I think, are looking at past precedent to say this could be something that backfires on Democrats or at least doesn't catch fire.
Polls show Trump's approval rating at just above 40%, historically weak for an incumbent president trying to fight off impeachment and seeking re-election at the same
time. Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is said to be actively preparing to enter the Democratic presidential primary with the expectation that he will soon be filing paperwork designating himself as a candidate in at least one state with an early filing deadline. So, what does he bring to the race? For that, I reached VOA's White House chief correspondent, Steve Harmon.
Well, what many see is a possibility for someone such as the former mayor of New York City to replace, essentially, Joe Biden, the former vice president of the United States. There's belief among some that Biden, although he's still leading in most of the national polls, that he's faltering and that more moderate position would be overtaken by a candidate such as Elizabeth Warren, who's seen more to the left, especially on economic, financial issues, and billionaires such as Michael Bloomberg think her positions are untenable. They don't like them, and possibly that she might be a weaker candidate against Donald Trump in the election next year.
So as Mike Bloomberg enters this race, he brings an arsenal of wealth. He's estimated to be worth over $50 billion. Does his wealth factor into this race?
Well, I don't know exactly what he's worth. I doubt he's even counted his money. But he is definitely far wealthier than any of the other candidates in the race, including the president, Donald Trump, who is a billionaire, but he's perhaps 15, 20 times wealthier than Donald Trump. So essentially, you have a billionaire from New York in his 70s running against a billionaire from New York in his 70s if Bloomberg were to get the nomination. Now, I think we need to be a little bit cautious at this point that Bloomberg, who has a number of times, including earlier this year, indicated he was interested in running for president and has always inevitably decided not to run for president, the same thing could happen again, that he may just explore the possibility and then decide not to enter the race. But he's definitely a big shadow looming over the race. And there's also a concern among those who would be apt to support him based on his positions as a more moderate or even conservative candidate in the Democratic field, that what he would essentially do if Joe Biden did not drop out would be to split that segment of the vote, giving someone such as Elizabeth Warren a much easier ride to the party's nomination.
So he's basically testing out the waters as it is, and he has done that this before. But how has the rest of the field responded to this potential run?
Well, I think he's being welcomed by candidates such as Warren and Bernie Sanders, who are both to the left of Joe Biden. And they see him as not a threat to their campaigns because he is so distinct in his policies, or would be from what they advocate.
Right.
And he's definitely much more of a threat to the campaigns of Joe Biden, as well as the mayor from South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, who is also considered to be a not only a white male, but also someone who has much more moderate position.
Now, a recent New York Times poll in six key states shows that voters want a candidate who is more moderate and one who is willing to work with the other side, the Republicans. Is Bloomberg this kind of moderate standard bearer that they're looking for?
In that regard, yes, much more so than a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren. But we've really never seen Mike Bloomberg out on the campaign trail, and he's not going to qualify for the next debate or two that's coming up. So we won't have an opportunity early on to see him going head to head with any of the other candidates. And again, at this point, he's not a candidate. He's just someone who's exploring it because of his background and his immense wealth and his high visibility. This is something that everyone's paying attention to and taking somewhat seriously.
You have been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOAIE. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Dan Brown. I'm Jackson Vunganya in Washington. Enjoy the day, everyone.